coming up on Boston Public Radio. It's that time of month as Governor Deval Patrick joins us in the studio at noon to take your questions and ours. We'll talk about his dissatisfaction with the transportation budget with a deadline just a day away, about what the delay of one part of Obamacare will mean for our universal coverage law. Oh, and answers on the nagging hands-free gas pump conundrum, Marjorie.
I can't wait. Christopher Lydon joins us to talk about the ouster of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi. Adam Riley on yesterday's arraignment of the alleged marathon bomber Zohar Tsarnaev, and Kara Miller on the secrets of happy families. I took the happy family quiz and I flunked. See if you can do better up next at 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. Easton Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
How are you?
I'm well. Joining us in studio, as he does once a month, every month for an hour, and Ask the Governor, is the governor of the Commonwealth. And by the way, if you want to watch him during this hour will be live streamed on WGBHnews.org.
Does my contract cover that?
I was about to say hello, Governor Patrick. How are you?
Hello,
yes,
Jim.
It is. It was in the fine print, actually,
hello,
which
Marjorie.
You chose not to read.
There you go. I want to get the governor's pen.
He said, how are you, Marjorie?
I was getting a pen because I noticed the governor did not have a pen.
How are you, governor?
I am splendid.
Oh, you saw, last time we saw you, you were a new grand. Did you see the grandkid?
Yes.
And how was that?
It's fabulous.
Oh,
incredible. He's a little peanut. He's he's gaining weight. He's off the feeding tube. He's off the respirator.
He's
maintaining his temperature. So we're hoping he'll be able to go home soon.
Great.
They have a special preemie clothes, I understand, for babies that are born prematurely because
they look like doll clothes.
Yeah, they do look like doll clothes. Little teeny tiny little outfits that they have for the little teeny tiny babies.
Funny little old man hats.
Well, congratulations.
Thank
congratulations.
You. I got in big trouble with my daughter for doing what I think all grandfathers do, which is share the picture with everyone you know. And she said, that's it. Someone posted it on Facebook, and she just lit into me.
You did
that's
the right
a private
thing,
matter.
Anyway.
Yeah, we get carried away with our Facebook
we
stuff.
Do.
Anyway, Governor, big day tomorrow, because you've got to make up your mind within 24 hours what to do about this $34 billion.
I have made up my mind.
You have?
What
are you going to do?
I'm not going to make any announcements here, but it's a good budget. I mean, there's a lot to like in it, I guess is the way to describe it. It has it reflects the initiatives we pushed in higher education, as you know, which enable UMass and other public colleges and universities to hold tuition and fee hikes this year. In other words, not to do tuition and fee hikes this year. It does a little better, not well enough in my view, but a little better in early education, which is helpful. In Chapter 70, a lot better. So there's a lot about it that I like. The biggest problem with the budget, Marjorie, is that it depends on revenues that are authorized not in the budget but in the transportation bill. And the transportation bill I don't like yet. There's a lot to like about that too, but it's portrayed as an $800 million bill when it's not, and that's a problem. So
because of the toll takers, is that what's
– Well, the toll takers, is
the
that
tolls
what's –
The tolls in Western Mass,
toll collectors, excuse me.
We should step back. You should say, Governor, if you don't mind, for those who haven't been following it, you requested roughly $1 billion in transportation
funding. Yeah, 1.2, right.
House passed $500 million, give or take,
right.
In tax increases to fund it. Senate, $500 million in taxes, but said there was an additional several hundred million, $800 million,
right.
On which you could rely to fund these initiatives. You have problems as
well,
to whether
it's
or not
just
those
not
additional
real.
Monies
I mean,
will
look,
materialize.
The need identified was $1.2 billion. And that is not the wants. That's a lot more. I'm talking about the needs. And it's that large because for a lot of years, long before I got here, we were neglecting those investments. And everybody knows it, right? It's the rusting out cars on the T. It's the viaduct out in Springfield on I-91, which needs not just reinforcement but replacement, and a host of projects like that. Most of that 1.2 was to pay bills already incurred, Big Dig related and otherwise, to take care of what we have right now, and then a few expansion projects that really are about unlocking economic opportunity in places that have been cut off. We've talked about this before. So South Coast Rail, extension of the Green Line, the rail line out in Western Massachusetts. That's a small part of that 1.2. We did a year's work on that at the request of the at the direction of the legislature, for that matter. And so it's a very data-based data-driven, fact-based plan, a lot of experts, a lot of financial analysis. And then after, you know, we went out and built support, you know, the polling, may I say, Marjorie, even in your newspaper,
there you go,
was in favor of our plan. You know, it didn't have to be exactly that. It didn't have to be exactly that that number. But people got that this was about a long-term fix, which is terrific, right? And then the legislative leadership announced the $500 million number. You know, there are no hearings on it. They announced it one day. They voted on it the next. That to me is not, as I say, the way to run a railroad. The Senate then started working on a bill they described as an $800 million bill. That's a better number. You can do a lot there with that number. And I said I would support it publicly and privately, provided the $800 million was real. And the number, the final bill has been sent to me, legislation that's been sent to me from the legislature, has a big gap. And that basically has to do, as you said, sorry, long way around, Marjorie, but to the tolls, because they're counting tolls on the Western Turnpike that come down in a couple years. And so that hole needs to be plugged. And I, you know, there are a bunch of different ways to do it, but it needs to be plugged if it's really going to be an.
You know, Governor, one of the things we had this discussion when you first announced this $2 billion, roughly a billion for transportation, a billion for early education. The Speaker of the House told me and other people the first he ever heard of this is when you made the public announcement. Now we read in the Globe this morning you haven't met with either the Senate President or the House Leader in the last 3 weeks, and it's a similar question I asked you at the time. Why haven't you? I mean, if the goal is to get them to move off the dime, and I don't mean that as a pun, why aren't you working with them virtually daily to get where you want to get, or at least
funny.
Get partway there?
I talked to the Speaker just this morning, and who is, you know, somebody I have tremendous respect for and I like a lot. We've talked about that before. I think he is feeling as perplexed by the personalization of this by some in the media as I am, and as I think the Senate President has felt in the past. We have a policy difference here. The bill that they have worked on, the transportation bill they have worked on, and you know, I've disputed some of those comments about, you know, our not working together, our working together. Look, we made some tremendous changes and advances in this Commonwealth in the last 6.5 years because we have worked together. And we've gotten as far as we've gotten on transportation because we've worked together. But we're not in the same place. That doesn't mean we're not working together. And I think it is fair to say that the Speaker and the Senate President are pretty dug in on the transportation bill as it is right now. That doesn't mean I have to agree because they're dug in. It does mean that I have to try to get their members to stand up to their leadership, and I am under no illusions about how hard that is to do.
But the second line in that Globe story, it says you haven't spoken to the leaders in 3 weeks until this morning. Is that true, by the way, that you haven't spoken to them?
No.
Nor has he made a major push to sway rank-and-file lawmakers. Is that true?
No. No. We're talking to members.
That was in the Boston Globe. I want to be clear.
This morning, yeah.
We're talking to members. We talked to a lot of members before the last votes. And some of those members pledged to vote against things they voted for, this is a policy difference. It's not a personal one. We're going to do, and as I said to the Speaker this morning, and he acknowledged, I'm going to do what I have to do. He's going to do what he has to do. I hope we land in a place with a better transportation bill than we have right now. That is a big, heavy lift because the leadership is so dug in. As I say, I'm under no illusions about that. If we don't, if the bill comes back to me in the form it is, I've been clear. And it, you know, again, it's not personal. It's about the people and what they want and what they say they need and what experts agree they need. So I'm going to veto that bill if it comes back to me in its current form. And then we'll go from there.
Our number, by the way, which I failed to give out, is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. You can send us questions on Facebook, which you're doing already, facebook.com/Boston Public Radio. You can email them to bpr@wgbh.org. Governor, can I ask you another budget question? And this is rather convoluted, but I think it's important. One of the central tenets of the Massachusetts universal health care law was the passed a handful of years ago, is the employer mandate.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is there's a provision in the same budget that would repeal our employer mandate in anticipation of the federal employer mandate.
Correct.
Even though they apply to different numbers of people,
correct,
10 plus in Massachusetts,
right,
50 plus. Well, while this budget is making its way to you with the repeal of our employer mandate, the president unilaterally decides to postpone the federal employer mandate for 12 months,
year,
as you
right
know very well,
mm-hmm,
till January of 2015.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is twofold. Is one, if you sign this thing, we are without an employer mandate in our law for at least a year. I assume that's true. And two, are you going to sign it as is, or are you going to repeal that provision? Are you going to veto that provision so that our employer mandate stays in place?
I'm not going to veto that. I'll tell you why. The employer mandate, you're right. We actually asked for the repeal of our employer mandate because the federal employer mandate was coming online at the beginning of next year, and there's no reason to have two. As you know, the national healthcare reform is based on what we've done here in the Commonwealth. So it was a kind of a natural segue. And then while all that was happening, the Obama administration, to my and I think a lot of people's surprise, decided to put off their own mandate for the national mandate for a year. Meanwhile, we have in place another program where all employers make a contribution to healthcare, the name of which escapes me right now. I want to call it, I think it's the Medical Security Trust or something like that. There's another program. We raise about, I want to say, $16, $17 million, Jim, from the employer mandate. We raise for healthcare. We raise about $95 million from the other one. That one is being repurposed for to make up the gap. So financially, we're ahead. And I think, you know, as long as the federal mandate isn't delayed beyond that 1 year, we'll be fine. One other thing I will say, though, is that experience has taught us that here in the Commonwealth, at least, employers aren't deciding to offer health insurance to their employees on account of the mandate. Right, it's because the programs make sense and they work
in terms of recruiting or retaining employees, that sort of thing.
Exactly, yeah. And the work we've done to contain costs, both for the policyholders and for the employers and their contributions, I think has mattered as well. So, we have gone up in terms of the numbers of employers who are offering insurance to their employees in the years we've had health care reform here, and we were already above the national average.
But just to be clear, despite this is second fund you talked about, and then we'll move on, we'll take calls at 877-301-8970, once you do what you're going to do tomorrow, there will not be an employer mandate in Massachusetts until the federal mandate kicks in, whenever that is.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Correct.
And one last thing that I think about. You say that there's no purpose. So the theory was there was no reason for ours if theirs was going to kick in. My understanding is ours covered employers 10 plus, correct? The federal covers 50 plus. So even if the federal mandate hadn't been postponed, employers that had anywhere from 11 to 50 people would have been required to provide health insurance under the state plan, but not required to provide insurance under the federal Affordable
no,
Care
still,
Act, correct?
Still required, but they have to pay a penalty I think a penalty is the right term. They have to pay a fee. And the way that's calculated is different. And so the point was to try to smooth out for interests of business simplification, to smooth out whatever the differences were between national health care reform and our own health care reform. And there are other differences that we've been working on eliminating or smoothing out as well.
You may remember Charlie Baker, by the way. I just thought Charlie was with us on Tuesday. Charlie, who was head of Harvard Pilgrim, obviously before he ran against you unsuccessfully a couple of years ago, and I'm paraphrasing, said he thinks the best course, because we have such a solid law here, is assuming that we have 97 or 98% coverage or whatever it is, some number that would be
98 plus.
Not, well, 98 plus, even mm-hmm. better. Why don't we just request an exemption from the federal law and decide that Massachusetts stands on its own with what you've characterized as a pretty successful universal health care law?
Well, that's an interesting idea. You know, it would require an act of Congress. It's hard to get Congress to do much these days. But, you know, the I'm actually quite proud of the fact that national health care reform is based on what has worked so successfully here. And I think we have one advantage that that the president doesn't have. And I say this repeatedly because I have found it to be a big part of the reality of our own success. And that is that this very broad coalition that came together to invent healthcare reform actually stuck together to refine it. And that's been key, because there have been learnings as we've gone along about how to make it better. And to have people so invested in its success willing to come back to the table and make adjustments so it would continue to succeed has been absolutely essential. That is not something that the president can count on. So there are all kinds of things people would like to do as they are learning and experiencing implementation at the national level, but they don't dare go back to the Congress because there isn't the appetite to make it better, to just have it or not.
Jim, do you have anything else to say before we move to the calls?
I was just trying to get a little tutorial on
We have some people on my 877-301-8970. Go ahead, Governor.
Shall I go ahead?
Yes, absolutely.
Ari is calling from Medford. Ari, thank you for calling.
Hi, Governor. Thank you so much for taking my question.
Sure.
My question is actually about this employer requirement, because it seems to me that the fair share requirement says that employers have to offer health insurance or else pay a penalty, and mm-hmm. getting rid of that undermines the notion that we do have all a stake in this health reform. And you talk a lot about the national importance of Massachusetts health reform to the rest of the country, and it seems to me that with all eyes on Massachusetts, it doesn't send a good message that employers would be walking away and saying, hey, this piece of the health reform isn't really necessary. And also, it seems to me that, you know, a part of the fair share requirement is that, you know, everybody has a stake in it. As you say, we have this great partnership between businesses and consumers and insurers and providers and all the rest. Just letting the fair share program lapse, say that, hey, you know, the businesses don't have as much skin in the game?
Well, Ari, let me take the second part of your question first. Like I said, instead of having businesses who are not providing insurance pay a mandate for the next year and a half, we have a program where every business is going to contribute. Every single one is going to contribute, and the aggregate of that contribution, by the way, is multiples of what the employer mandated the fair share contribution would be. So the affordability or the financing of healthcare reform is, in fact, better off than not. So I think we can afford the bridge. I think the other thing to your first point is, you know, that the evidence here in the Commonwealth has not been that people have offered businesses have offered insurance because they would pay a penalty if they didn't, and that's the point I wanted to make. I wanted to make it earlier. It's not that feature isn't an important feature, and if there weren't going to be a federal replacement for that feature, then I don't think anybody would have the appetite to repeal the fair share. The question is, what are we going to do between now and then? And we thought now and then was 6 months. The now and then is now 18 months. And as a practical matter, I think we can do that. And if there's any evidence that businesses are bailing out because the fair share requirement has gone away, then I am fully confident that the legislature will come back and reimpose the penalty for that bridge period.
Ari, thanks so much for your call. Our number is 877-301. My apologies for that. 877-301-8970 is our number, and bpr@wgbh.org is our email address, Marjorie.
You know, Governor, we're getting emails on this, so I'm asking this question on behalf of Keith and Paul and Diane, who posted on our Facebook page about this. You know, my paper, The Herald, has been relentless in all this welfare fraud and abuse and EBT card and stuff, and found a lot of significant abuses. Now, Shauna O'Connell, state representative, has to go out and pay $800 to get records about which she has now gotten that found that people were basically stockpiling money on their EBT cards and food stamps. And, you know, one person's got, I mean, most of them were not fraudulent, but a lot of them were, you know, $1,500 there, $4,000 there. So my question is, why should Shauna O'Connell have to pay $800? And now that she's performed such a worthwhile public service, you're going to pay her back, reimburse her, find a way to... Because she was doing something legitimate.
First of all, I'm not going to treat her or anyone else differently from everybody else. The rules have been around long before me about folks having to pay for the copies they want of... So that's the first point.
But you can chew in this modern age on the email. I mean, you put it on the computer.
Well, like, talk to the IT people about that. Oh. I think she's the one who wants it. I mean, and nobody's charging her, by the way, the considerable staff time of producing all this information. I think it's also important to acknowledge her and you and your paper and others. Surfacing these issues, I think, has been very important. I think it's going to lead to some good comprehensive legislation. I think keeping them in perspective has been a tremendous challenge because even you, as you were just talking about, you know, seeing these high balances, what those high balances indicate is that there are questions that have to be asked, not necessarily that there is fraud. So asking those questions and the initiatives that that we put in place in order to assure that those questions get answered, I think is a really, really good thing and is good for us all in the long run.
But here's the thing, we had Brian McGrory in here yesterday. He was talking about transparency.
Who happens to be the editor of the Globe.
The editor of the Boston Globe. He was talking about transparency in your administration. Didn't give you great high marks. You know, I'm a reporter. I love government transparency. But this is a philosophical question. I get the sense, and maybe I'm all wet, that you're not keen on a lot of right-to-know stuff for voters vis-a-vis government records because she had to go fishing for this. And from my estimation, this is part of the government's obligation to make sure. And the reason, especially with welfare fraud, because you know, Governor, from your own life, people that are legit welfare recipients get embarrassed and humiliated by this when they go through the checkout lines
exactly
and people look
right
at them askance. So
exactly right.
It's incumbent, it seems to me, on the government to say, you know what, we're going to make sure that everything is on the up and up. But I don't get the sense from you, and maybe, I'm all wet, that you're keen on this kind of stuff.
I think that's a really unfair charge.
You do.
I mean, we are the people, by the way, who put every dollar the government spends up on the web in the open checkbook.
Yeah,
we've won awards for government transparency. The budget has been available not just in budget speak, but in regular people speak up on the web. I just don't think that's fair. I think my quarrel, to the extent there is one, is that we struggle, all of us, I think, to keep what we learn in perspective. The amounts spent in public assistance are in the billions. I wish they weren't, but they are. I wish they weren't because I wish there wasn't that level of need. We find out about lots of, but a relatively small amount of things that raise questions, and it blows back on the whole program. It blows back on the worthiness of these programs and on the people, and frankly on the efficiency and effectiveness of the people running the programs, and trying to keep that in some perspective is a very, very hard thing to do, I think.
Let me just ask you one more thing along these lines, and I'll shut up about it. But
don't shut up.
It's okay.
It's your show.
It is my show. But part of the reason I think that there's this reluctance is, let's go back to the Tsarnaevs. When they were first arrested, there was a lot of clamor to find out how much public assistance they'd gotten. And that did finally come out. It took some time. But I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, we ever found out whether the younger bomber, alleged bomber, I should say, was getting a scholarship from UMass Dartmouth. And I get that there are privacy laws. But to me, again, this is such an abomination, and people were so worked up about the horrible prospect that Tamerlan Tsarnaev might have been helped by state money in his little efforts to be sitting home and allegedly building bombs, that we could have got that information out right away, that we didn't have to, like, pull teeth to get it. We still don't know about UMass Dartmouth.
Well, I don't know the answer about UMass Dartmouth, and I think you've gotten what the law permits us to give. But, you know, you can't ask me. Well, I guess you can because you have.
Yeah.
And other people do. It doesn't matter what the federal rules are or the state rules are. Give it to us because we're curious. I totally get that instinct.
Yeah.
But that's not my job. My job is not to either protect the information or to broadcast stuff that violates the law. My job is to respect the law, and that's what we've been trying to do.
He's Governor Deval Patrick. He's with us till 1 o'clock on You. When we come back from a very brief break, he will take all your calls at 877-301-8970, and he will unlock the mystery of the self-service gas issue that has been posed every month for decades. We'll be right back.
A summer stroll down Newbury Street is the perfect preview for the Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend, presented by Citizens Bank. Nearly a dozen galleries will feature hors d'oeuvres and cocktails on Wednesday night, July 24th. Stroll, nibble, and sip while you browse artwork that'll be up for viewing and bidding throughout the Summer Arts Weekend. Check out all the events happening in Boston's Copley Square, July 26th, 27th, and 28th at bostonsummerarts.com.
We love our contributors. That means you. And the Museum of Science, where you can uncover a portal to ancient times at the new Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit. See what life was really like over 2,000 years ago. More information at mos.org. And Northeastern University, where researchers are creating sophisticated computer programs to put the world's cyber criminals out of business. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marge Regan. He is Governor Deval Patrick, kind enough to spend another half hour with us, as he does a full hour every single month. Our number is 877-301-8970. You want to go back to the calls, Governor?
Sure. Let's see. Lauren is calling from Reading. Lauren, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
How are you?
Hi, Lauren.
I'm fine, thanks. I'm on my landline, Marjorie, so you can hear me.
Oh, great. Thank you.
We had a long discussion,
very
Governor,
much about landlines
landline right?
versus
yes.
Cell phones in audio quality.
Lauren, are you a regular?
I'm calling about education. I'm a teacher, so I'm a regular in the summertime.
Oh, God bless you.
School year. All right.
Do you teach in Reading?
No, I teach in another town.
Mm-hmm.
But
she's traveling
calling
incognito.
Go ahead, Lauren.
I'm incognito. No, I am calling about Reading, though.
Mm-hmm.
Reading is a race to the top school,
yes,
for which we got over 3 years, approximately $35,000.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to implement the new Common Core standards.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been very surprised at what these standards actually look like. And I'm among a group of parents who have been really concerned about the new math standards, because they appear to be lower than what's already been in place.
Mm-hmm.
And in our district, it means that they are limiting the availability of algebra in the middle school.
Don't do that.
Well, then you need to talk to my superintendent. calculus at the high school to only about 15% of the population, because our superintendent's telling us that because of the Common Core, calculus is no longer necessary for admission into colleges. Which is, it's making no sense to us, but they keep saying because of the Common Core, they're changing the math curriculum from K through 12, and the end game is no longer calculus, but it's now pre-calc.
So, Lauren, you are right to question that, because the deal in participating in the Common Core, since our standards almost universally across the board are higher than everywhere else in the country.
Is that
the Common Core, to the extent there was a difference, would come to us, not that we would go to them. So I would, you are right to push back on this. I know there's a lot of work. I'm not current as of this moment on the work around around Common Core. But the deal in working with them was that we were not going to compromise any of our existing standards, and that to the extent we had something to contribute, we would be setting the benchmark. It would be us or higher. And if there's a delta in terms of a lower standard, then we would that we would respect our own existing one. So you're exactly right to ask those questions. And I'll ask some questions back at the Department of Education as well.
Lauren, thank you kindly for the call. We appreciate it. Governor, back to the phones.
Let's see. Richard is calling from Bedford. Richard.
Hello, Richard.
Whoops.
Whoops, we lost Richard.
I think it's something I said. Richard, are you there or you're not? Let's try another one, Governor, if we can. We'll get him back in a second.
Let's see. Linda, calling from West Falmouth. Linda, you there?
Good afternoon, Governor.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. I want to congratulate you on your new grandchild.
Thank you.
I'm a grandparent myself, and great joy in store for you.
It's wicked cool.
Yes, it is. Now, my question is, I'm wondering what you'd tell your daughter to do if she had to bring your grandchild home to an hour or more of strobing shadow flicker day after day and pulsing noise, pressure, and vibration in his bedroom.
You're talking about wind turbines?
Wind turbines.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not very far from wind 2 down here. Mm-hmm. I fear the effects on my visiting grandchildren. They're not even living here full time.
Mm-hmm.
When I see them holding their ears at my house, which I don't see them doing at their own house.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know if you will support House Bill 2048 to get some independent medical research on the effects. Health effects of wind turbines.
Thank you for
telling
me.
What would you tell your daughter? I'd love to know.
Thank you for telling me what House Bill 2 so and so. I never know the numbers, but this is the one for other listeners. And correct me, Linda, if I'm wrong about this. This is the one that would have an independent scientific study done about living or being in close proximity to land-based wind turbines. Is that right,
Representative Peake? Proposed study, and I think it's much needed. It, for once, it doesn't put the burden of proof on the suffering people to say that, you know, to prove harm. It assumes that there is probably some harm, and it seeks to see what is the extent of that harm. And I think what we really want to know is if these things are harm free. They've never been proven harm free. Even your special panel said they were not proven harm free. We want to know that they're not harming us. We feel it. We feel the harm, but we want to know.
Well, I'm not going to object to an independent scientific study. My guess is that an independent scientific study is going to say that there's one set of harms. If there are harms, if you stand under it for prolonged periods of time, and that they diminish the further away you get. But I don't know that. I presume that's true. And some of the issues around the wind siting bill, which we tried a few years ago, were precisely about having Commonwealth-wide standards about the appropriate distance from where people live, where land-based turbines should be put. But that was that didn't move in the legislature in the end. So if the question is if that bill, as you have just described it to me, comes to my desk, will I sign it? Sure. I'd be happy to sign it.
Hey, Linda, thanks for the call. Richard is back. He disappeared. He has reemerged. You're on with Governor Deval Patrick. Hey,
Hi, Richard
from Bedford.
Hello. Do you hear me?
Yeah. Sorry about that. What happened?
Oh, that's fine. I'm not sure. What I was calling for, Governor, is I consistently travel between, you know, my home here in Bedford in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And excluding the toll booths, I could tell you when I cross from Maine to New Hampshire into Massachusetts by the litter.
Hmm.
I think there's a twofold thing here. We could raise revenue by fining people for littering, and we could clean up the roads because they were well cut and maintained in that respect, but they were full of paper and diapers. And
diapers?
Ugh. I mean, it's disgusting. it's a joke to the people up in New Hampshire and Maine that you can tell when you cross the Massachusetts line from all the litter.
You're going up 95 or 93?
93.
And
unfortunately, it's true.
Unfortunately, as well.
It's true. He said it. Yeah.
Well, I haven't noticed
How about it, Governor?
Should we clean up the road?
especially
the diapers.
I mean, I think the question, Richard, I think we lost you, is are we fining people who are doing littering on the roads? I assume we are.
I don't know the answer to that. But, you know, it's fun. Do you ever watch this show, Mad Men?
Yes. No. Oh, yes.
So I watch it every once in a while, and I was looking at old seasons, and I was looking at one where they had the main character and his wife and young family on a picnic. And they have, and there's, you know, out in some park somewhere, and the car is parked nearby, and the picnic is over, and their paper cups and napkins all over on the blanket, and they take the blanket and shake it out, and pick the blanket up and walk off,
and leave it there.
And it reminded me in the 60s when I was growing up,
which is when this show was from. Yeah, yeah.
The notion of taking your, your soda.
Yeah.
A cup when you were done and dropping it out of the window was not unheard of.
No, it was
my
not.
Grandparents wouldn't permit it, but you saw it all the time.
Oh yeah,
and the litter bug campaign that started, I think, in the Kennedy or the Johnson administration
had the controversial ad with the Native American. It turns out he wasn't a Native American. Remember with the tear coming down?
Yeah, I remember
was
that.
He Native
yeah.
American or not?
He wasn't Native American.
He wasn't Native American. Yeah. Anyway, it was a great.
We apologize to all our young listeners who don't know what we're talking
Have
about.
Have you ever
right
seen
now?
One of your predecessors walking through parks?
Yes.
In Boston
Bless
with a
heart.
Garbage bag
Bless
picking up
heart.
Garbage. That, of yeah. course, would be the great
I
Michael Dukakis,
great Michael
I should say.
Right.
Marjorie, you had a question.
Well, we have to get to one of the great issues that is people have been emailing and calling
you
about
ask me
now
about gas.
For weeks now. Yes, we are. The hands-free gas pump. Apparently, you know, people are bothered about big things and things that aren't so big. A lot of people are upset because you can't, when you press your hand onto the gas pump, you can't let it go. You have to keep it there.
Yes.
Now, you've done some extensive research on this, I understand.
So I'm holding
Governor
before me a BlackBerry with a message on it from Bonnie.
Okay.
Bonnie is her colleague, his press person right here.
Did she print it out so it's actually in type I can read?
Type, yes.
What's the answer, please?
So the clip prohibition dates back to 1975 as the state was moving toward allowing self-service gas stations, talking about going back a while. As a provision of making self-service stations available in Massachusetts, the Board of Fire Prevention Regulations made it a state requirement that all clips had to be removed from gas pumps, and the regulation still stands today, and it has to do with static electricity.
Who knew?
Who knew? Now, this is not in the in what I'm reading, but it still begs the question, because a bunch of other states don't have this.
Yes.
And I got to believe they worry about static electricity around gas stations as well. So maybe we ask the fire marshal to take another look at that.
You know, Speaking of explosions on a much more – a larger plane, we got an email from a person called Ellen. I believe it's E-L-L-I-N, so I assume it's a woman. Please ask the governor – this is at bprwgbh.org – to sign the amendment to the budget to prevent changes to the Chapter 21 license request made by global partners to allow rail transport
91.
Of ethanol
– Chapter 91.
I'm sorry, 91.
Yeah.
Into the Revere facility. And for those who don't know, all the global partners has withdrawn its request. It may come back. The horrible explosion in Quebec, as we all know about, of rail cars loaded with petroleum products demonstrates how dangerous rail transport would be in our densely populated region. So where are you in this, Governor?
That's a serious issue. You said Revere. I think it's Chelsea. But anyway.
She said Revere. I don't know, actually.
There's for listeners who don't know what we're talking about, there's an ethanol tank, I guess, at a facility up the Chelsea River. And most of the ethanol, or I think most, has been brought in the past by barge, some by truck. And there is a request, or there had been a request, I think it's been withdrawn, by the owner of the facility to bring ethanol to the facility by rail. And because the rail is close to a waterway, it requires a so-called Chapter 91 license. So there were some who said, don't issue the license. Others who said issue the license with conditions. There's a provision in the budget that seems to speak specifically to this. And the question is it just about this or does it have blowback elsewhere? And that's what we're trying to work our way through.
Governor, one last thing before we get back to the calls. The teacher called about Common Core before.
Mm-hmm.
Marjorie and I spoke to a woman who's a professor at Portland State College yesterday based on a story we both saw in the New York Times, which we loved. I know you're concerned about the funding of public higher education. We've talked to you about it a ton of times. It's this pay it forward concept. Have you heard of this thing?
Mm-hmm.
Basically, for people who weren't listening to it, Oregon now, this passed unanimously in the legislature. Every Republican, every Democrat voted for it. It would spare public college students any tuition bills while they're in school. Afterwards, they pay back to the state once they begin working a share of their income based on ability to pay. Is that something that has appeal to you? We both love the concept.
I love that concept. I mean, and I know about as much of it as what you described, Jim. I like the idea, and we talked about this briefly in the past, of service obligations. I feel in so many respects the Israelis have kind of got this right. They require either military or other service for a period in a young person's life.
Mandatory, we should say. Mandatory, yeah.
Get those kids off the couch in the Nintendo game.
No, it's hugely important.
It has a whole lot to do with common cause and common destiny. Yeah, yeah.
So this is something that has appeal to you?
Yeah.
Good. Okay, let's go back to the calls.
Let's see. Gene is calling from Providence. Gene, you there? Jeannie. I'm sorry. Is it Jeannie?
It's Jeannie. But
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Not a problem.
You know that he's not yet governor of Rhode Island. Do you know that, Jeannie? I just want to be clear.
I do know that.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I have a funny story about this, about that point. But you ask your question.
Go ahead, Jeannie.
So I work with medical students. I admit students to medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered last November that legislation was signed that will allow Massachusetts residents to do primary care residencies in Massachusetts and will receive a loan forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to know the parameters. So how much does it kick in during residency? Do they have to give years of service after they complete residency and hopefully get a job as mm-hmm. a primary care physician in the state? Could you elucidate a little bit on the parameters of the legislation?
I can tell you some of it, Jeannie, and then hang on and I'll get somebody to give you all the details. But let me give a little background for listeners who may not know what we're talking about. There is a national concern about whether we have enough primary care physicians, particularly given the emphasis on universal health care and the importance in controlling costs and improving wellness on having preventive care. So moving more of the decisions to primary care providers is a big presumption of the strategy of success of healthcare reform, but we have to have enough primary care physicians. And what has been happening, Jeannie, as it's described to me, and please correct this if I'm wrong, is that medical students have been trending away from primary care because by the time they accumulate the amount of debt to go through medical school, what you get paid as a primary care physician isn't really enough to deal with that debt. So why not be a specialist in this or that? So a strategy that was proposed to us actually several years ago now, I want to say 4 or 5 years ago, Jeannie, was to come up with a program to do loan forgiveness. And we had help from Bank of America and a couple of others. We put a little bit of state money in because a little bit of state money is all we had. And then we had to back off when the bottom fell out of the global economy, frankly. We're trying to repurpose that now and refortify it and make it last. But it does require, Jeannie, that you practice as a primary care physician and you do so in Massachusetts for a period of time afterwards. But I don't remember all the other details. If you will hang on, I'll get your contact information, and we'll get you those other details.
Jeannie, don't go away. So what's the producer will take your number, give it to the governor. You are running for governor of Rhode Island? Is that the story?
No,
or what?
No.
What is the story?
No, the first time. So when I was running in 2005 and 2006, I went down to see the newspaper in Providence. I went to see everybody. I even went to see the Herald.
You did?
Well, I did.
The Fall River Herald or the Boston Herald?
No, she means
the Boston Herald.
It's a joke, Marjorie.
It's not a joke. I did go to. I pay my respect.
Absolutely.
But anyway, I was meeting with the publisher down there, and just a wonderful conversation and a kind of a quirky guy. And he said, "Well, let me tell you." He said, "If you win, he said, we'll endorse you if you promise to annex Rhode Island." And it's such a funny thing for the guy from the Providence Journal Constitution, I think it is, right?
I think it's just plain old Providence Journal.
Providence Journal.
Yeah, it used to be a great newspaper. It's shrunken like so many papers, which is very sad.
Governor, before we get back to the calls, I don't know how you felt, but I at least one of us was really upset about the turnout in the special election in the U.S. Senate race somewhere in the high 20s. Mm. Yesterday, I read that either you, I don't know who has the statutory authority to do this, either you or Secretary of State Galvin, based upon the statutory restrictions that exist, said the election to replace Ed Markey in the House, the 5th District, will take place, I think, on December 10th, 17th, or the day before Christmas. That's the only spectrum of possibilities. Is it not time to revisit the whole special election law that was changed by Democrats so that Mitt Romney couldn't appoint a Republican to replace not just perpetual, but the whole horrible turnout because it was the middle of summer. The notion that people be asked to replace a congressperson right before Christmas Eve is almost insane. So what is your position on the notion that essentially give you back the power that once existed prior to the Democrats taking away from Romney? You pick replacements until the normal election cycle. Are you in that?
Well, I mean, I like it, but it doesn't mean it's going to turn into law. And it's not a priority of mine. I mean, I totally get that there is a certain amount of election fatigue. We feel like it has felt like we've been in perpetual elections, and there's this cascading effect, right? Somebody runs for the other thing, and then that creates a vacancy, and then other people who are already in office run for the next position, and everybody is moving up or over, as the case may be. I wish it weren't this way, but you know, I respect the rules, and everybody gets a chance to say. So there you are.
You know, I remember you were pushing the plan to ban commercial food waste for renewable energy. What's that about?
You did?
I did. Guess you forgot.
You mean ban the use of commercial food?
Yeah, instead of having all this commercial food waste just dumped out from restaurants or cafeterias or whatever, use it for renewable energy. Well, maybe it was the governor of Rhode Island that did that.
I'm sorry, you caught me.
It's okay. Don't worry about it.
You got me there.
I just think it's a great idea.
When you say ban it, I know that you can use
it. Encourage.
Yeah, no. So we're there. Yeah. I'm sorry. You made it sound like we were saying you couldn't throw out your food waste.
No, wrong verb. Encourage.
You had to run a Futz capacitor or whatever that thing was.
But that's kind of neat.
What was that machine in Back to the Future? What was it called? A Futz capacitor?
Many people think that Ox capacitor. Thank you, Chelsea. Flux capacitor. Thank you, Chelsea. Yeah.
Okay.
In any case, let's go back to the calls. I have no idea what that was about. But in any case, Governor, back to the calls,
if
you
would. Let's see. Jennifer is calling from Quincy. Jennifer, you there?
Hi, Jennifer.
Hello, Governor Patrick.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling about how much I really, really appreciate Massachusetts healthcare, our healthcare reform. Mm-hmm. Laws. I've basically lived in Massachusetts my entire life, and I think the types of health care we have in Massachusetts is fantastic, and it serves, you know, as we all know, it's serving as a model for national health care as we move forward to the full implementation of the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I've gotten concerned about, though, is that as many of us have read about, there's now going to be, on federal level, a delay in the employer fair share requirement on the federal level.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my understanding that on the state level, when the budget was being created on the state level, that the employer fair share requirement was taken out.
Mm-hmm.
Of the requirement. Under the understanding that that was going to be a requirement federally.
Right.
So I am asking you to veto the repeal in the state budget. And I know this is very timely. It has to be done, obviously, this week, just because it is working so well in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
We discussed this at the top of the show, Jennifer, but maybe since you just tuned in and others did, Governor, if you could do a quick recap, if you would.
I'm sensitive to the point, and you're right. We got a little bit of a change in – not a little bit, but a year's change in condition in the midst of all this working its way through the budget. So the question for me, I think, Jennifer, is can we bridge from now to – January of 2015 without fair share? And I think there's a pretty good argument for both on the policy side and the fiscal side that we can. But I think if there is concern about employers backsliding, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, Jennifer, but if the concern is that employers are going to stop offering insurance because of the relatively modest penalty they would pay under Massachusetts going away, then I think the legislature is poised to step back in.
Jennifer, thanks for the call. Governor, one of the obsessions of Marjorie Egan, Emily Rooney, and I, all colleagues at the WGBH.
There are
so glad
several.
You remember
now, this,
this
is one that we are that we have been talking about virtually every single day. You know that in state courts, virtually without exception, cameras are allowed in the courtroom. You know that in federal courts, with virtually no exceptions except appellate courts, cameras are not allowed in the courtrooms. There's a Boulder trial. There's a Tsarnaev arraignment yesterday.
Is it just making you crazy that you can't have your cameras
on? I assume in some ways it might make you crazy. I mean this sincerely. As somebody, we talked, you and Marjorie had a little thing before about openness and all that sort of thing. These Tsarnaev, Bulger, being prosecuted in our names. You're formerly a Justice Department leader. They're being prosecuted in the names of the people of the United States. Unless you go to an overflow room, which is what Marjorie went yesterday, we don't have an opportunity to see our own government and its trials at work. Where are you on this whole cameras in the courtroom
you
thing?
You really want to turn me into a pundit, don't you?
No, but I'm sure
you want me to have an opinion on everything.
You
want me to have an opinion not just on the judiciary, but on the federal judiciary.
I guarantee, I'm sure you've thought about this and
thank
talked about this.
Thank you all for having me. It's been great to be with you.
You never had that
is
discussion?
Our time up?
You're a
no.
lawyer, Diane.
I'm
your
afraid
wife
I have
is
to
a
go.
Lawyer. So what is your, seriously, does this not bother you?
Let's see. Tony
I guess
is calling from Providence.
Bother
Tony.
You.
Jim and I are starting a crusade on this. We just wanted to know.
Hi, Tony. Welcome to Boston Public Radio with Governor Deval Patrick. Hey, Tony.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to clear one thing up real quick. Earlier, the governor said that the flux capacitor is what Doc used to recycle garbage for his time machine.
Yes.
The flux capacitor is what made time travel possible. What Doc used was a Mr. Fusion, which is a gadget he got in the future, which would recycle waste products into energy to power his
And it looked like a Mr. Coffee, right? Didn't it look
exactly,
like...
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
Tony, thanks for the correction.
I wish you had called sooner.
This is about the governor's plan to ban commercial food waste, which you were...
ban
the
flux capacitor.
Associated Press. Please do not give me something from... I'm sorry. It's a different
Press.
Newspaper.
Associated Press.
Let's go back. Tony, thanks for the correction.
It's going to take effect in a year. I just want you to know.
Governor, back to the phones, if you would.
Peg is calling... Excuse me. Peg is calling from Jamaica Plain. Sorry.
Hi, Peg. Good afternoon.
Hi there. Nice to talk to you.
Hey.
So my question is regarding the Casey overpass in Jamaica Plain that is slated to be torn down and not replaced.
Yes.
And there's a huge backlash here in Jamaica Plain of people who would like to see it replaced. And we want to get your opinion on it.
Well, I'm not sure my opinion matters. There was a lot, but yours does, and other members of the community. And there was a long process, I think a year's process, of gathering that opinion and input and reflecting on it. And I think there was even a survey done, and the overwhelming opinion was in favor of taking it down. When I was out in JP, I want to say about a month or two ago, I went to something at Doyle's, and some of the leadership from the folks who want to keep it up were there.
What is it?
And do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't know.
I'm sorry.
I don't know what the Casey overpass is.
I'm sorry.
Or someone can explain.
So, Peg, when you're coming down from the Arboretum, are you on the Arborway at the point when you come to the Casey overpass?
It depends on who you talk to as to what it's called. It can be called the Arborway. It can be called 203. But this is the overpass that goes over the whole Forest Hills.
Okay.
Yeah.
Into the Rotary. I know what you're talking about.
Exactly. So when you come over and you come down to the park and the Rotary is at the end. And it's
on the way to Dorchester.
Exactly.
Yep.
And it's in terrible shape. It's now so weak that the two lanes in each direction are down to one lane in each direction, and it's pockmarked and so forth. And the question is whether to take it down and rebuild it, restore it, or take it down and recreate the surface roads down there. And the most cost-effective and the most popular has been to take it down and recreate, restore the surface roads. But there is a vocal opposition to that, and it sounds like, Peg, you are among that opposition.
Yeah, and the vocal opposition is growing as people see more of the details that are coming out about the plans for the surface traffic and all of that. I agree that, and originally I was sold on taking it down and not replacing it until I saw what the options were. And the numbers are growing of people who are looking at this thing. It just can't work what they're proposing here. 24,000 cars go over that daily. they'll be adding five or more traffic lights to that, interrupting the cross traffic, and they claim it's going to affect the traffic by 1 minute. And we just don't know how they can get those statistics.
Well, in fairness to the case, and you know, you talk about the numbers growing. That's the nature of a campaign, and the opposition has mounted a campaign. But in fairness to the process, the plan, the alternative plan, is not new. It's not a surprise. It was a part of the public vetting, and I'm gonna defer to that process and to the experts.
We only have a minute left, Governor. Peg, thank you for the call. Governor, I know you don't like punditry, but I think this is sort of in your wheelhouse as the former head of the division you ran at the Justice Department. Voting Rights Act gutted by the Supreme Court a couple of weeks ago, and literally, as you know as well as anybody, within minutes of this decision, places like Texas implement unilaterally provisions that the Department of Justice, federal courts had said were violative of the Constitution in terms of voter ID and that sort of thing. It seems to me the only thing that can happen is for Congress to revisit this issue, but they can't even agree on what time of day it is. I'm serious. As former head of the division,
it's a serious concern.
What is a recommendation of someone like you as to what can happen?
It's a serious concern because, you know, while many, many things in the so-called covered states under the Voting Rights Act have changed, the creativity around how to drive an outcome and to do that by disenfranchising voters has just evolved. It's not gone away. It's evolved. And I think, and by the way, the Voting Rights Act has been extended to jurisdictions outside the old South.
Brooklyn,
as well.
New York is one of the covered areas, parts of California.
Because they were, now, the Justice Department still has the authority to bring an individual lawsuit when there is demonstrated discrimination in intent, at least. Question is whether they still have the power to bring a lawsuit, or whether they can win a lawsuit where there's demonstrated impact, not intent. But the problem with the lawsuit is the elections happen.
It's after the fact.
Yeah. It's over.
It's scary.
Right? So it's a very, very worrisome thing. And the Congress has the power to come back and fix it. But whether they have the will or a political ability in this gridlock time is a big question.
Governor, thank you for your time. This is where the governor usually says, Jim, don't forget to remind them if they're on the line or if they sent a Facebook posting or a tweet or an email. They're all conveyed to the governor's office, and they will respond to you promptly. Governor, it's good to see you. Thanks so
great
much.
Great to be with you.
Thank you very much,
Governor
Patrick, for coming Governor in.
Governor Deval Patrick. Coming up is what, Marjorie?
Oh, coming up is Christopher.
I did.
Coming up is Christopher Lydon, who's with us every Thursday at 1 o'clock. We're going to talk about the overthrowing of the democratically elected president in Egypt. Was it a democratic move in disguise, or was it a military ouster? Christopher Lydon joins us up next. Stay tuned for that conversation. 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
New England Fish Performing Arts Superstars of Tomorrow in Dance, Music, Musical Theater, and Opera. bostonconservatory.edu. And the Lincoln Motor Company, featuring a panoramic retractable roof on the 2013 Lincoln MKZ that opens up to over 15 square feet of skylight. More information at lincoln.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. There was great rejoicing, everybody knows, in Egypt and throughout most of the world when Hosni Mubarak fell in 2011. Similar emotions when Mohamed Morsi was freely elected president of Egypt about a year later. But if you'd been in Cairo last week, would you have backed Morsi to protect the process of electing leaders and bearing up under them? Or would you have supported the judgment that Morsi was incompetent and the Muslim Brotherhood was subverting the spirit and letter of the revolution? Joining us to take on these questions is Christopher Lydon. You know he joins us every Thursday at 1 on Open Mic. You can find him online when he's not here 24/7 at radioopensource.org. Nice to see you again, Chris.
Pleasure to be here, Jim.
You just got back. You were in Egypt late last year?
I was there in November for most of the month, and I have to bill myself as a total non-expert, but a devotee of that revolution. and deeply interested. You phrased the question right. I mean, was this an evil military coup, or was this the will of the people expressed in millions of signatures, millions of people, maybe 20, 30 million people on the streets of Cairo and major cities in the whole country? I mean, it is what my friends in Egypt are talking about, and they disagree, and I will go through it. But these are vital questions. It's a deeply dangerous moment for the biggest country, the most populous country in the Middle East, and we're engaged. I mean, one of the things we got to talk about is where is the Obama administration? And they've been all over the place, including on the golf course and, you know, sailing in Nantucket. And
that would be John Kerry you're talking about.
And would be our president, who I mean, to me it was astonishing that when Egypt was sort of going up in flames, he was demonstrably on the golf course.
And by the way, for those who haven't been following this closely, well, the Obama administration, as Chris is suggesting, did celebrate the free election of Mohamed Morsi. They have been, I think I'll be kind, equivocal in terms of where they are on what happened when the military decided to remove the president several weeks ago, Morsi.
Well, I'm dying to know what you think. Do you think this was a military coup, or do you think this was a triumph for democracy? Because many Egyptians, the millions, if you point out, feel as though they were sold a bill of goods, and the initial election of Morsi really didn't have a choice. It was Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood, or it was someone that was with Mubarak that they felt was going to be another dictator.
And well, the short answer, Marjorie, is it's both. I mean, unmistakably, it has all the look of a military coup. And not only that, it was a coup that was triggered. The last green light came from Washington. We'll get to that. But yes, no, of course, this was a tank maneuver, in effect. And
of a freely elected president, regardless of where he stood on issues.
Exactly. And it's a profound question. At the same time, it was a hugely popular rejection of a guy that had screwed up at every turn and who also was degrading the dignity of the whole country. I mean, he was a fumbler and a bumbler and a power grabber, and maybe not even in charge of the Brotherhood. So I think you can make a wonderful case, and the best people...
On either side.
Yeah, but we should flesh it out a little bit. Let me just say, though, on the ambiguity of the Obama administration, it goes deeper, Jim, than just being sort of wishy-washy. The Obama administration helped the Brotherhood get elected. They put together the deal with the army in the election that made the Brotherhood, that said, okay, you guys can work together and we will continue our financing of the Egyptian army, we the Americans. But it goes back to Obama's Cairo speech in 2009, in which he said, you deserve a government like yourselves that's transparent, that meets your huge needs. Some people think that planted an important seed. But then, when I was in Cairo in November, around Thanksgiving time, Gaza had been shelled unmercifully by the Israelis, 150-plus civilians dead. Morsi played a small role in bringing that shelling to an end. Hillary Clinton immediately showed up in Cairo while I was there, and the Egyptians were shocked. Oh, no, they said, every time the U.S. comes to Cairo, we get screwed. And what this really means is that Washington has found a comfortable Mubarak again, who will sort of tolerate what Israel has done to Gaza, but sort of be a vaguely a good guy about it, but embrace him. And then the very next day after Hillary left, he declared his autocratic rules. I'm above the law. Democracy will be on the shelf for a while. And everybody I met on the street in the cafes in Cairo assumed that Hillary had said, go for it, guy. I mean, you're ours, and we'll be with you, and stretch out as you will.
Well, let me just interrupt there and say, well, there's another analysis. And by the way, if you want to weigh in on this, if you have strong thoughts about what's going on in Egypt and whether it was a democratic revolution.
If you know more than I do, which is probably.
Well, that's clearly more than me. 877-301-8970. You know, there is a thesis that not that she cut a deal, But then no matter what, there was a great report on National Public Radio yesterday. Whatever the United States says in the person of the Secretary of State or the President of the United States, that's exactly the opposite of what happens. A couple of months ago, the president said the red line for Syria is if they use chemical weapons, then we're not talking anymore. Of course, they use chemical weapons. We didn't do anything. The line after the ouster of the president a couple of weeks ago was, okay, but there can be no violence. The next day, what, 51 people are killed. And it's conceivable that the whatever Hillary Clinton might have said to the then president, the attitude was blank you, essentially, rather than her being a collaborator. There's a real question as to what level of influence and respect the United States has in that part of the world, particularly because of the behaviors around Syria and being too late to the fair, maybe the first time around Tahrir Square and those sort of things.
Well, I think that's part of the whole confusion, Jim. And we bumble. It's hard to know what we want to be in that part of the world anymore. After Hillary Clinton embraced Morsi, and it did him a lot of damage in Egypt, the sense was that, you know, the money keeps flowing, the military relationship is firm. Morsi's sort of correctness on Israel and other things that are important to the United States is on track. And then, even in the last 6 weeks, they decided to pull the plug. And this is unmistakable now. And the New York Times has had some interesting reporting on it, including a day before the army took him out, a foreign minister from another Arab nation went on the United States' behalf to Morsi and said, either you give over the government and stay as a kind of ceremonial president, or you're out. And he put his hand to his throat and said, yeah, I'll swing. You know, they'll hang me before I'll take that deal. And then, according to one of the aides, it was lovely, it said Susan Rice had called and the ambassador had called. And one of the aides in the meeting with Morsi said, Mother just told us that we will stop playing in an hour. Meaning Mother America is blowing the whistle. You're out of here.
But interestingly, we're not cutting, despite what happened, we are not, you know, the whole John McCain versus Barack Obama issue about foreign aid. McCain's position is the law in the United States states very clearly if there is a military coup, and it seems to me this is a textbook military coup, even if it was in response to the democratic uprising of millions of people, if there's a democratic coup, that removes a freely elected leader, end of discussion. No more aid to that country. Yet the Obama administration, they, as you know, Jay Carney, the spokesperson, won't call it a coup. He refuses to use the C word.
But can we talk a little bit less about the United States and, you know, our deal and what the deal is for the Egyptians? I mean, what is good for the Egyptians? Because frankly, I know we're a small world. We all have to pay attention to this. But you know, I what's good for the Egyptians seems to me the bottom line here.
I couldn't agree with you more. Let me just say, from my experience in Cairo, and I've been there two or three times now, and I don't pretend to know it, but you'd love being in Cairo. I mean, these are marvelous people.
And had been very sophisticated in a very sophisticated
enormously
country.
Enormously sophisticated in their own terms, but also much closer to Italy, France,
yes,
England, to the Mediterranean in general, to Greece historically and in the present day. These are smart, modern people with a huge poor population, but that's another matter. I got to put it in terms of the man I kind of most trust, and I think about him a lot. His name is Ali Alaswani. He's a novelist. He's also a dentist, and I sat in his dentist chair. He's a wonderful. He trained. Got
we
his
heard
dog.
You on the radio talking to him.
Oh,
great.
Yeah. Well, he's a one. He's sort of a bull of a kind of a middle linebacker sort of guy. Heavy smoker, gruff voice. Trained in Chicago, very sophisticated about the world, and an arch Democrat. And it struck me that, first of all, he struck me as Norman Mailer of Cairo, a guy in the street. He's been having an open public seminar, imagine this, for 15 or 20 years on literature and politics. And anybody can come and does come. I didn't get it because it was in Arabic, but this is a man of the people. He has a wonderful line. I said, what is this about being a dentist and a novelist at the same time? He said, medicine and novel writers are two branches of one profession. I said, what do you mean? He said, we are both students of human pain.
That's great.
And we look into the mouth and say, where does it hurt? And what's up with you? But this guy became, I mean, not everybody loves this guy. He also wrote a marvelous book that anybody could enjoy, The Yacoubian Building, a kind of social profile of Cairo under Mubarak. All kinds of corruption, sexual corruption, predatory police, a whole mix. But he told it all in the population of an old office building. I mean, an old apartment building, sort of from the doorman to the squatters on the roof, etc. He's the real thing. And when it came the moment, he debated the Prime Minister Shafiq, the guy who lost to Morsi, but a holdover from Mubarak, figurehead for the army. It was, and he said to me, I don't want to sound vain, but he said the whole country was watching. And he wiped the floor with this guy, Shafiq. Shafiq had to resign the next day. But among other things, he said to him, he said, don't give me this, you know, you are the father, you want to be the father of the country. That makes me a child of the country. And people will not take it anymore. He was also striking, for me, one of the huge themes of this long Egyptian revolution. It is about patriarchy. Fathers coming down. They even regret the obeisance to Nasser, but certainly Mubarak, who was two generations older than the median age of his population. The idea of these old men ruling the family, ruling the household, ruling the country, ruling the public square is crumbling, which is part of what Ali Alaswani was thinking.
But and his view, by the way, we should say, his view is that what happened in the last 10 days was not a subversion of democracy, but it was an exercise. Here's from a recent piece. The Egyptian populace decided to end the Brotherhood's rule, and the leader of the army had no choice but to implement the rule. The people save Egypt from an imminent civil war. Thus, the army did not carry out a military coup. Rather, they implemented the will of the people. You know, but the problem I have with this, and obviously I'm not there. Obviously, I don't have the level of understanding that he has in his, well, you know what I'm trying to say. It seems to me when there is a democratic election, particularly a landmark democratic election, and the people are wildly unhappy with the results, that's I'll make a ridiculous exception. A lot of people, a huge percentage of people thought that George Bush was subverting the Constitution.
I don't think this is a
good example. Well, I know you don't, but I'm going to say it anyway. Should we rise up in the streets and say that George Bush should be removed from office? The answer is no. If democracy gave you the wrong choice, now either it's because of the economy, it's because of the sway of the Muslim Brotherhood, it's because of the unilateral power grab, at least the whatever it is, there was a free election.
But that,
are the military to decide that the popular will is that a freely elected leader should be removed from office?
The country was crumbling. Are you supposed to wait around indefinitely for things to get better? I mean, that's the
who's
thing.
To decide
well,
that?
You know, want
I think that the question. People in the streets were deciding it.
There was a young photographer who worked with us over there, Mossab, who wrote an equally wonderful piece saying this is a disaster. The armies are never interested in democracy. We'll never go back. We'll never have a contested presidential election again. This is a huge loss. There's a lot of double dealing and a lot of sort of willingness to ride the fascist tiger. You know, Morsi's election rode on the sort of Twitter revolution, but now the Twitterites are ready to ride the army back. This is all incredibly dangerous. Again, why I think we need much, much sort of more modest but clearer guidelines from the rest of the world in the United States. Much more sympathy. Let me just come back to one. I keep thinking, what is Ali Alaswani thinking today? And I want to be with him. And as long as he is free to stare down the prime minister, to write what he does, in the face of the Brotherhood, you know, they say Islam is the answer. Every piece this guy writes, including the one that you read from, Jim, the last line is always democracy is the answer. He really believes it. He practices it. He's
usually preceded by Islam is not the answer. Democracy is the answer.
Well,
correct?
He doesn't need to remind people that they're always saying the Brotherhood was always saying Islam is the answer. He says, no. First of all, political Islam is not Islam, and it's a big mistake. I'm sure he's a Muslim himself, but that democracy is the answer. The institutions of democracy are the answer. But then he taps into something that I felt and millions felt in Tahrir Square. In January of 11, in November of 12, just last year, and God knows in the streets today, there's something there's something almost extraterrestrial going on in those streets. It's not simple politics. It's not a narrow complaint. It's a kind of, I took it, and I still feel it in my bones, as a sort of an emergency cry for all of us. The climate in Cairo is terrible. Not only everybody smokes, but the fumes in the air are toxic. But that's the least of it. The poverty in that country, the neglected, the runaway capitalism, the corruption in government and in business is, and the sort of pathetic dependence on the IMF and on the United States is wink and nod and all this stuff. It's a general condition in the world, and God knows we're seeing these almost indescribable, undefinable revolts and street action all over the world. I think it has to be acknowledged, and in a certain sense, it has to decide the day. And in that sense, I'm for the spirit of the revolution. The revolution must be preserved.
Yeah, but see, one of the, you and Marjorie have focused most of your attention, which I guess makes sense, on what does this mean for Egyptians? What's best for Egyptians? I'm concerned after a presidency where the reputation of the United States in the world was at as low an ebb as it can get. My guess is the perception right now is this. We believe in democracy throughout the world unless you choose the wrong leaders. If you use democracy to pick someone who we don't like, then we're okay with a military coup leading to, hopefully, to another set of elections. Isn't that the obvious perception that comes out of the fact that the president is not being terribly strong on this issue after being very strong in support of the free election of Morsi a year or so ago? Isn't that pretty obvious?
That we're not there for democracy.
We're there for democracy if the democratic outcome is one we like. If the democratic outcome is not one we like, then we're not there for democracy.
Or that we always support dictators, and this is another indication of our supporting a dictator.
Which is a variation of the same thing.
That's a very good point, Jim, that we're not committed to democracy in a big way. There's a kind of declining sense of acknowledging the public will, even acknowledging promises, and you could even say in this country. I mean, our very own beloved president has reneged on so many commitments. Certainly, you know, he has made the notion of a deep state in our country a kind of chilling danger. So, yes, the profile of democracy is low. On the other hand, I think there is a lowercase democratic people spirit in an almost sort of holy sacramental way in these crowds in Tahrir and elsewhere. And I know that the army, in a certain sense, built them up to get rid of Morsi, and that all sorts of, you know, schemers, you know, built those crowds and made them a sort of a world event.
So when's the next trip to Egypt, Chris Lowe?
Oh, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go. And again, I would be consulting the novelists, the poets, the musicians, the filmmakers, the historians. It is very hard to square. When Tony Blair says, hello, I reach for my gun, and he is all in favor of this so-called coup, and let's, you know, bless the revolution. This is a man who ignored massive protests against his own, you know, support of the war in Iraq. So he's my idea of a sort of a neo-imperial hypocrite. Danger. He's the only guy in the world who could have stopped the war in Iraq and didn't. But so his support of the coup makes me deeply suspicious of some sort of neo-imperial designs. On the other hand, one of the most learned and respected historians in Cairo, a guy named Khaled Fahmy, gave us a marvelous interview. I mean, he'd been in the streets. He was talking about how the brother of a man who works for him had been beaten to death in a police station just a matter of days ago. And this was the breaking point for him. He was all for the procedures. He was all for, he had not voted for Morsi or Shafiq, but he had been relieved that the Brotherhood was taking a role in government, blah, blah, blah. And he overcame any number of disappointments. But when his friend's brother was beaten to death in a police station, he said, no, this is the end. They're not making any acknowledgement of the revulsion against this official thuggery, and they've got to go. So I don't know where I come out, except that I think it is important for the species that this revolution be given room to unfold. And it's a mysterious thing. It is. I came away, as you know, from Egypt feeling I had seen sort of a work of art, almost an unexplainable cry from the heart. Like, this has got, we've got to meet, gather, confront the mystery, act for all kinds of reasons, and that must somehow be sustained. It's probably a very romantic and maybe silly way to think about it. But
are
these
interviews on your website, by the way?
Yeah.
We heard them on the radio. Give everyone
what's
the
website?
The place where you can go.
RadioOpenSource.org, and there are probably 25. I made a point of not talking to politicians, but I did
there
try to
architects
talk,
and novelists and musicians
and city planners
and painters
and human rights
teachers.
People and I mean, they know the longer story. Egypt is in a long turmoil. It's been going on for a great part of this century. I also have to put in a plug for Naguib Mahfouz, the novelist. I learned more from his novels in the Cairo trilogy than I learned from being in Cairo. But that's only because, they sort of end in the 1950s. But he is on to this collapsing patriarchy that daddy does not know best anymore. And it's time for a huge expansion of rights. There's one other guy that I think of as sort of my little personal monitor of the revolution in Egypt. His name is Khaled Abel Naga. And he's a movie maker. He looks like Warren Beatty. I mean, he's a fabulous actor, kind of a matinee idol. And he went back to Alexandria to see, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, to see he'd been in America, to see if he could make a life there. And what he discovered was that in his hometown, Alexandria, the whole pulse of the life was underground. Musicians, actors, filmmakers. And then he decided not only he belonged among them, but he wanted to make a documentary about them, which he did, called Microphone, really making the point that they didn't have a microphone. They were all unofficial. They were all underground. He would say, there's no stopping this revolution. This is a human awakening. You can't put people back in an army box, as of 50 years ago. And of course it's going to succeed. It's going to be tough, and it'll have setbacks. But anyway, I keep thinking, as long as Khaled Abel Naga and my man, the novelist, Ale Aliswani, are alive and speaking and confident in their country, sort of on with it. They will get over the breaking the rules of a political procedure. They will get over the trauma of seeing an elected president sort of ushered out. It's pretty tough. But the spirit of some sort of greater Egypt ambition and self-assertion, I think, is going to survive.
Chris Lydon, it's a pleasure. See
My
you
pleasure.
Next. What day is today?
Today is Thursday.
Thursday.
All day.
See you next Thursday at 1
o'clock.
Christopher
Lydon is with us every Thursday
care,
at 1 o'clock. Tomorrow at Bless 1 you. O'clock, of course, is Open Mic with Emily Rooney and the world-famous Emily's List. Okay, cameras are not allowed in the courtroom to cover federal trials. That means the Whitey Bulger trial. That means the arraignment yesterday of Zokhar Tsarnaev, the alleged marathon bomber. Adam Riley joins us next to go over what did happen in court yesterday, because he went there physically, actually, so did I, to see it. That conversation next, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
I'm James Edwards. I live here in Brighton, and I report here in Boston. Well, I do this because of the accountability.
The chamber's salary is far and away the highest in the state. And I would say that one of the reasons for that is that it is the largest, probably most complex urbanized environment in the state that has a city manager form of government.
Me sticking with journalism is sort of the work and kind of that sense of public good in a way. James Edwards, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Citizens Bank, presenting sponsor of the Summer Arts Walks and Talks. Art and food and music in Back Bay are all a part of the Boston Summer Arts Weekend in late July. Info at bostonsummerarts.com. And This Old House, this Emmy-winning series allows you to follow the experts through the complete renovation process from beginning to jaw-dropping end. This Old House, now on Thursdays at 8 on WGBH 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. As you know, yesterday a 19-year-old alleged bomber was arraigned in federal court in Boston. You didn't see it because the Supreme Court and Congress don't think you have a right to. But Marjorie Egan and GBH's Adam Riley did. They're here to share the experience with you. And by the way, if you want to call in, feel free to rail against the no camera in the courtroom rules. Hey, Adam Riley.
Hey, guys.
It is really terrible because when you go down there, I was complaining to Adam this morning. I haven't been to the Whitey Bulger trial. I went yesterday to the arraignment of Tsarnaev, and I was stunned by how unlike him the images I've seen on television or the paper, the drawings.
Why don't you start? Let's step back. Why don't you start where the two of you were yesterday in courtroom, overflow room? Where were you, Marjorie?
Well, I was in the overflow, one of the overflow rooms for regular people. You can just walk in there, and I walked in there, and the cameras are right on where Tsarnaev was standing with his two defense attorneys, two women, actually middle-aged women, that were constantly patting him on the back. And stunned at how, I mean, I wrote this in the Herald this morning, he looked like anybody your high school son would have over, you know, kind of the hair down above his eyebrows, baby-faced. He was obviously, you could see the injuries he'd suffered because he'd been shot multiple times.
Yeah, the left side of his face was sort of swollen and drooping down. It almost looked like what you think of someone who's had a stroke looking like. I mean, it didn't, the left side of his face.
Where were you
broken.
Yesterday? Adam?
I was in the media room. There was some ambiguity. I thought I was going to get to be in the courtroom itself. There was actually some ambiguity in the way they handled allocating spots to the media. So I ended up in the overflow room, the media room, which can either be a good or a bad thing, because we had the same perspective that Marjorie had, looking straight at Tsarnaev, sort of like, I think, the same perspective the judge would have had. So a very, very clear shot of him. What you don't see is the periphery.
Yeah.
You don't see, you know, his family members, for example. But sometimes if you're in the courtroom itself, it can actually be a little harder to read the face of the person who's
testifying. What was it like? I don't mean this question either of you as much as reporters, as humans, not that those are mutually exclusive notions. This kid accused of, mass murder, I guess you could say there, and other crimes. You haven't seen him at all except pictures when he was younger and all the same pictures we've seen thousands of times. What was it like, start with you, Marjorie, when you actually saw the face, the live face of this young man close up?
Well, you know, I had the same reaction to him I've had in many trials I've covered as a reporter over the years. When you see this person in front of you, you can't believe that they were capable of doing what they're accused of. I mean, very few defendants look like stone cold killers and mass murderers. I mean, there are some that do. I mean, Whitey Bulger hissing the other day in the courtroom, it is, and showing that just in the edge of blowing up that temper. And Kevin Weeks, it was with him in the Whitey Bulger trial. But he looks, and this is going to be a factor in the trial. You forget, there may not be a trial, but if there is a trial and it lasts for 4 months, as they were talking about yesterday, then for 4 months, a jury is going to look at this young man, this baby faced young man in front of them day after day after day. They'll see the occasional image of Martin Richards, the little 8-year-old who was murdered allegedly by the Tsarnaev brothers. They'll see the people that lost their limbs and their legs, but and all those horrible pictures. But day after day, hour after hour, it's this young man, 19 years old, they're going to see. That can have an impact on the jury in terms of their sympathy.
What did you feel when you saw him for the first time, Adam Riley?
Well, I would sort of echo but alter what Marjorie just said. I feel like when you see someone like Tsarnaev, or when you see someone like Whitey Bulger, who when he was brought in, you know, didn't look like the threatening figure he's become in the trial. He just looked kind of a
little old
looked
man.
Like a doddering old fart. Yeah. You expect these people, someone who's done the things Whitey Bulger is alleged to have done, or someone who has looked to take life with maximum efficacy, like Tsarnaev, it certainly seems, looked to, you expect there to be kind of a reek of sulfur or something almost demonic about them. And there isn't. Again, Bulger looked like this old coot, and Tsarnaev looked like this kind of, I thought he looked dazed and confused when they dragged him out. I thought he looked like he'd just woken up. As Marjorie mentioned, the hair was going everywhere. It was like he tried to maximize the bedhead effect. He was also really fidgety, and I was trying to figure out what to make of that, and I didn't know what to make of that. You know, scratching his chin, scratching this cast on his left
itchy.
Arm, looking this way, looking that way. And I found myself wanting to, maybe in a way that's almost irresponsible, but wanting to figure out what his behavior said about his mental state. I didn't know if he was totally terrified and trying to keep it together, trying not to, you know, melt down into a puddle in the courtroom. I didn't know if he was trying to show how calm, cool, and collected he was. So he's, you know, scratching his chin and looking around as all these horrific charges are read out. You remember, after we learned that he was probably one of the bombers, do you remember that tweet that someone uncovered that he had sent a day or two after the bombing? And my recollection of the tweet is that it was something like, I'm a low stress kind of guy.
Yes.
Well, I'm a low drama kind of guy. So I found myself wondering, is he behaving this way because he wants to show us what a low drama kind of guy he still is? Someone else pointed out to me on Twitter that a couple people took offense with me throwing out these possibilities and said, well, maybe he has brain damage. And he might have brain damage. You know, again, the left side of his face clearly had suffered a massive trauma.
And his mouth did not look normal at all.
So maybe, no, not at all. So maybe his, you know, maybe his mind is still recovering from some sort of physical trauma. But yeah, you expect them to be evil incarnate. And like Marjorie said, he could have just been any kind of, you know, overly disheveled teenager who you see on the street or you see in your kid's class.
You know, one of the things, I was not there, and I'm jealous that both of you were. One of the things I did see is, and I'm sure you did too, was yet and heard, where there were demonstrators. There were pro-Jihar demonstrators who came from throughout the country. Let's just hear briefly. I believe these two people, one is from Las Vegas, and the second one, if I'm not wrong, is allegedly from Washington State. Is that correct, Will? In any case, are we ready to hear those? I think we are. Are we ready to hear those? Not yet. We'll get to those in a couple of seconds. That, you know, and everybody has a right to do whatever they want to do. But it almost felt to me, what's that group? It's almost like Westboro Baptist Church.
Yeah, they're nuts. Wing dance, as Emily called
who
them.
Who was able to get, when you said anybody can go in there, meaning that you didn't go to the media overflow.
Well,
you
no, because I I'm thought talking, I'd go to a place where there would be other people that I could interview about what they thought of them. That's why I went to the other room. But there was immediate, there was.
And
there
what
was,
kind of, who was there? I mean, what kind of people show up for this thing?
Two kids from Everett came down, just high school kids, just wanted to sort of see
just
him.
Just curious.
I think they may have. Wrestled against him. Another guy was a school teacher that just was off for the summer, lived nearby, wanted to come in. There were, you know, there's always been court hangers on, you know, the people that are retired, their whole
they
life
just go
is
to
going
court
from
like
trial
every day,
to
yeah.
trial to trial. There was some of that cartoon. There were a lot of people that worked there, and there were a lot of lawyers that work in the federal courthouse, which, if you haven't been to, is a spectacular
building.
Oh,
it's gorgeous. I was waiting outside the courtroom hoping to get in, and the people I saw lining up for the public seating
in the courtroom.
In the courtroom itself, there were the pro Tsarnaev conspiracy theorist. I interviewed one young woman who was wearing a shirt that she told me she actually makes and distributes to people. And it said, free the lion, and had a great big picture of a snarling lion with underneath it a small picture of Jihar, and then down under it had yesterday's date. And I asked her why she was here. She said she's friends with some friends of Tsarnaev's. The woman, for what it's worth, maybe important detail may not be, was wearing a white headscarf. And I asked her, you know, in addition to being a friend of his friends, what is it about the case that you think is flawed? She told me she doesn't believe the evidence against him. I asked her to give an example, and she said, well, you know, there's that image that shows him leaving the scene of the bombings without a backpack on. But that image was actually sent away for analysis, and they said it was Photoshopped. Mm-hmm. Now, she didn't tell me who had, you know, done this analysis that determined it was Photoshopped. But she basically thinks, we didn't have a chance to get into who she thinks framed Jihar Tsarnaev and his brother, who was really behind the attacks. But, you know, she doesn't believe that they really happened the way they
did. You know, my sense of those, I know this is not a terribly sophisticated thought, isn't even so much that I am troubled by the fact that people who are like that choose to speak, because obviously they have a right to. It is so grotesquely insensitive to people whose loved ones were either killed, lost a limb. I mean, the mother and uncle of the Norden brothers, both of whom lost a leg, were there. Mm-hmm. And the notion that they not only have to sit in the courtroom with a young man who allegedly took a leg from each of their children and nephews, and then have to walk past these other nuts. In any case, here are two of them we promised you a minute ago. Listen up.
He saw us, he smiled, he knows he's got support out here. I'm not an extremist, I'm not a terrorist. I'm a supporter of innocent people.
I truly believe he's innocent. For one that I've kept repeating is Jihar's backpack was white, Tamerlan's was gray, the backpacks that exploded were black. Okay, well, Jihar's backpack was white. How did he do this then?
She should be one of the defense attorneys. Now, can you describe, both
white
of you said...
White backpack? I missed that.
What is the deal? Judy Clark, who is obviously the woman who's developed
penalty.
A career getting people like Loeffner and the Unabomber, allowed them to escape the death penalty. Is it Miriam Conrad from the Public Defenders? What did one of you just describe that they are regularly, like, touching on the shoulder? Or what are they doing?
Constantly comforting patting him on the back. Mm-hmm.
Physically comforting him.
Yeah, and the image was that he's a surrogate son. Yep. That's all I could think of, you know, that they're, like, middle-aged women, and this is their son. And, of course, his parents are not there. His we believe the two women that were there were his sisters. I'm not positive of that, but we
And to your earlier point, patting him on the back that way, it kind of infantilizes him and makes him seem like this vulnerable young kid, you know.
So maybe even
guy.
A conscious move, even though there's no jury. It's just to get
you know
a...
who did this constantly?
Yeah, no jury.
Andrew
yet.
Good did this constantly during the so-called nanny trial of Louise Woodward. Always patting her on the back, and didn't work with the jury, but it seemed to have worked with the judge who let her out.
Just to hearken back for a second to the conspiracy theorist, what drives me crazy about this line of argument, whether it's in this case or 9/11 or any other, you know, big tragedy that you might want to mention is that these conspiracy theories are airtight, because if something comes up that could disprove them, like, for example, if Jahar Tsarnaev ends up in a few months taking the stand in court and saying, you know, yeah, I did it, and here's why, and launching into this denunciation of U.S. military policy in the Islamic world, it won't matter. It just gets folded into the conspiracy theory itself. And then the response would be, yeah, well, you know, he was beaten up in prison, and they made him say that. They told him they were going to kill him if he didn't confess to it, or they drugged him, or whatever. There's no way you want to break through to the people who think this way, but you can't. It's almost, by definition, impossible to rebut the claims they're making. And it's a little maddening.
Let's take one call. Sheila from Norton, you're on the phone with Adam Riley and Marjorie Egan and me. Hey, Sheila.
Hi, and I love listening to Adam Riley.
He's great.
He's not so bad. Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks, Sheila.
As well as you guys.
Thanks.
But I a couple of things. One is, it's sort of nice that he is now grotesque on the outside, perhaps as much as in the inside, with his injuries to his face, of all places. I hate to say that, but perhaps he won't be a prom date now for some.
Well, it wasn't that bad. It was bad, but it wasn't that bad.
Because I was thinking we could only hope. But and the other comment I had to make was, I'm sort of troubled that with the public defender that he is allowed to have, he has a team. I don't know if we should be paying for him to have a team of lawyers. And I wondered if anyone knew anything about the mother saying that there had been a fund, and if that would affect his ability to keep counsel being paid for by the state versus having to pay himself.
Excellent question. Sheila, thanks for the call. Does anybody know about the lawyering situation?
I mean, I guess I would point out that Whitey Bulger has a team, too. He's got J.W. Carney and Hank Brennan. But in terms of a fund being established that might make it inappropriate for him to have representation that we're paying for, that's
remember the early stage of the Zimmerman case. Do you remember when Zimmerman was had a publicly funded lawyer, and then it turned out there was a fund? Sal DeMacy, who was the former Speaker of the House, who was doing quite well until apparently trial time, owned a condo in the North End. He had a public. Did he not have a publicly funded lawyer,
I believe
in his trial as well?
Did.
I mean, it is something.
Lawyers are expensive. You run out of money quickly.
No, I understand that. But I know you, of all people, will appreciate the concern that a lot of taxpayers have.
Oh, yes.
When they see people, on one hand, I think most of us respect deeply the notion that you're entitled to some level of representation. But as Sheila said, who is, I know personally, and you do too, is pretty sensitive to decent representation.
We know who'll be paying for his own lawyer.
What's
Aaron
that?
Hernandez.
Well, that's probably
the
interesting thing
about Sheila's point. I mean, I understand emotionally why it's hard to tolerate watching people who, in all likelihood, did terrible things, have taxpayer-funded representation. In some cases, there actually is a strong public interest. Like in the Whitey Bulger case, Tommy Donahue, the son of one of Bulger's alleged victims, made the point outside court recently, which I found really striking. He said, it's tough for his family to watch the trial because on the one hand, they want to see Bulger, you know, die in prison and they want to see justice done. But on the other hand, they feel like J.W. Carney and Hank Brennan are the only guys who are ferreting out the full truth, not only of what Bulger did, but of what
his
enablers did.
The FBI and everybody else.
Yeah, so here's a victim's son who's saying that the defense attorneys are helping us figure out what really went down, all the bad stuff that went down. I don't know if there's an argument like that to be made in this case. I mean, based on my understanding of the evidence implicating Jahar Tsarnaev, you know, there's almost no question that he did it. And there's not a question, I don't think, of anyone enabling him in inappropriate ways. There is a question. One of the questions lingering in the Marathon bombings is whether some aspect of law enforcement, whether it's, you know, the people investigating the murders in Waltham or the FBI and the CIA and BPD sharing information or not sharing information, whether in some way it could have been prevented. But I don't think that's something that Judy Clark would ferret out in the course of the trial. So, you know, in Bulger, I think, again, you can maybe not feel so bad about the public paying for his attorneys. In this one, it's hard not to.
Adam Riley, thanks as always. Really appreciate it. Adam
Thank
Riley
you.
From
thanks,
WGBH.
Guys.
Take
Riley.
Care of yourself. See you soon.
Okay. Tolstoy famously wrote, all happy families are alike. But do they all find happiness the same way? Karen Miller joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Riots broke out in Oakland after an unarmed man named Oscar Grant was shot and killed by a transit officer in 2009. Now, Oscar winner Octavia Spencer tells us about her new film about the events that shook the Bay Area.
I wanted to be a part of something that would have
a certain social impact.
We go to Fruitvale Station next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Citizens Bank, presenting sponsor of the Boston Summer Arts Weekend, featuring a Globe Insider's talk on the inside world of reality TV chefs, Monday, July 22nd at the Revere Hotel. Info at bostonsummerarts.com. And the South Shore Music Circus in Cohasset, presenting Garrison Keillor's A Prairie Home Companion Radio Romance Tour 2013 on July 26th. And the Tenors Lead With Your Heart on August 24th. Tickets and info at themusiccircus.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. So, what makes a family resilient, effective, and even happy? It surely is not those dreaded and often dreadful holiday gatherings. So what does work? Here to answer that question is Ms. Innovation Hub herself. That'd be Kara Miller. Hey, Kara.
Hey, how's it going?
Excellent. Thank you.
So, yeah, I mean, this, I think this topic really interested me because there's so much anecdotal evidence about, like, oh, here's what I do to make my family better. Here's what doesn't work. But it's all from your great aunt, whoever, and
right.
Who knows whether that really makes any difference. So this guy from the New York Times, Bruce Feiler, he's their sort of life family columnist, and he went out to look at the scientific research on families, what makes families work and what doesn't. There's a bunch of stuff here, but I'll start with a really interesting story. And the story is this professor at Emory, he was trying to figure out, okay, how do you make families strong? And he's a psychologist, married to this other psychologist. And one of the things she started noticing with the kids that she was working with was that the kids who seemed more resilient seemed to know more about their families. So they knew things like, where'd your mother go to high school? Jim, do you know where your mother went to high school?
Philadelphia.
I have
no idea where she went to high school.
I think you're asking the wrong person.
Okay.
Yes, I do. She went to Sacred Heart Academy.
There you go.
Well, my mother went to Sacred Heart Academy then, too. No, I have no idea. Go ahead. Continue.
So anyway, they started asking people things like, where'd your mom and dad meet? I mean, like all these things, like the story of your family, right? And then that was the late 90s, early 2000s. And then September 11, 2001 happens. And they realized this is horrific, but this is a great chance to test kids' resilience. Because if you had a kid around then or you knew a kid, kids were totally shaken by that.
Oh, yeah.
Right? They watched it on TV. They didn't know what was going on. They saw adults around them sort of, you know, freaking out. And so, okay, so they went back to these kids. And it turns out, yeah, the kids who were the least shaken by September 11th, were the kids who could answer these questions, like, where'd your mom go to high school? Where are your grandparents from? How'd your parents meet? These stories of their family.
Jim.
What?
How about the grandmother that hit you in the head with the frying pan?
She did not hit me. She threw a frying pan at my head.
Before that where your mother went to high school?
No, it was my grandma. My mother would not. One of my grandmothers did throw a frying pan at my head. She did miss.
Well, we understand she might have gotten annoyed.
No, I don't think you do. You mentioned it. You know where your grandparents grew up. Do you know where your mom and dad went to high school? Do you know where your parents met? Do you know of an illness or something terrible in your family? Meaning it doesn't have to be just good news,
right,
too. Do you know the story of your birth? It is stunning. How, you know, when you read those, you shake your head and you say how basic they are. But if I'm any indication, I don't know 90% of this. So they have, now I'm concerned. They have science behind this notion that the more you know your family's narrative,
yeah,
the whole family narrative, the good, the bad, the whatever,
right,
the more resilient you are, the more you stick together as a family, the happier are you, all that sort of thing.
I mean, that's absolutely right. The more resilient you are, you tend to know a lot more about your family. To me, it feels like
It makes sense.
Right? Because you've spent a lot of time with these
Where'd your
people.
Mother go to high school, Kara?
University High School in Los Angeles.
Did you have to look it up before
you
actually
knew
it?
No, I did not.
I think it is, too, that you understand you're part of something bigger and larger than yourself.
Right.
And also, as the story points out, if you find out that your grandfather got run over by a freight train and he was in little pieces and yet he put himself back together enough to go on, then you think, okay, we've endured the bad, we've endured the good, we've been lucky, we've been unlucky.
Right.
That part, I find, it makes such sense.
Right. So it turns out, it turns out there's actually these three kinds of narratives that families tend to have. So I cannot wait to hear what Jim's family narrative is. But here are the categories.
Thank you, Kara. I appreciate it.
It's ascending. So, like, we came from nothing. You know, your grandparents, you know, they didn't even go to high school, but your dad and I, we finished college, and we hope you're going to go to graduate
right.
school or something like, right, you're ascending. There's descending. Well, we used to have a lot of money, and then the war came, and now we really don't have anything, mm-hmm. you know, right there. And then there's the oscillating narrative, like, well, it's true Uncle Joey went to jail and, you know, Aunt whoever made a lot of money. But, you know, we've sort of had ups, we've had downs, we get through it as a family. And it turns out that the strongest families have the oscillating family narrative, so that the kid doesn't feel like all this pressure is on them, but they also don't feel like they're a family in decline.
It's actually brilliant. I mean, it really does make total sense.
What about the...
My family was all three of those, by the way. It was ascending, descending, and oscillating, if that was your
question. Depending on the week.
But, you know, the one thing that did concern me as a mother is that we're supposed to have a mission statement. And I thought, I don't think I have a mission statement. What is my family mission? Now, what kind of mission statements can you have? Because I have to go home and implement these things right away.
I know. I don't have a mission statement
either. Make sure I'm not falling
down
the job.
I know. Well, my daughter's 4 months old, so we have to get right on this.
That's right, before it's too late.
Yeah, exactly. No, so this comes – there's actually a bunch of research in this book that Bruce Feiler wrote that comes out of this idea of – that companies have spent a lot of money on research into how do we make GE and Facebook run really well. Well, if they've already done the research and spent the money, maybe we should be implementing some of the things that they figured out help groups to function well. And one of those things is mission statement. And it's so funny when they do the research and they sit down with kids, the kinds of things that kids come up with, because they are listening to everything you say, when you don't know,
right?
You know, well, mom says that this is what this family is about, and you had no idea that this kid heard it. But yes, one of the things that research shows is that coming up with a mission statement for your family is actually very helpful.
We're talking to Kara Miller from the Innovation Hub Thursday night, Saturday morning, so we'll get into details in a minute. Stay on the corporate thing for a second. So the more you know, the more there's a narrative to your family, the more resilient, effective, whatever adjectives they used, happier, I think those are the three. How about in the corporate world? I mean, we both, I think we can speak for all three, is we love working here. Let's assume we were neutral about where we worked,
right?
But the employer implemented the same narrative notion about where we work. I want to tell you a little bit of history about the company. I want to tell you about the founder, why he or she decided to put this thing together. I want to tell you about some of the good shows, the bad shows we've done. Does this research suggest that it would have the same impact on us as workers as it does would as family members?
That's really interesting, and I've talked to a lot of people about rethinking the workplace. Almost everybody who I talk to about that says that when employees can have a real investment in their workplace, I mean, that which speaks to what you're saying, this idea, right, of saying, like, we're all part of this together, we've had bad times, we've had good times, rather than the boss being, and I've had people say to me, this is like the idea of the boss being the parental figure is over. It really, people want to work in places where they're on a team, they're a really respected part of the team. Some ideas come from the top down, some come from the bottom up. Another really interesting thing that families are doing is they're borrowing from software engineering, where very often with software engineering, every day they have a scrum, like in rugby, you know, and they say, like, here's what we're doing today, and everybody contributes to it. And this is something that is sort of taking over family meetings. And it turns out a few things. One is, when you have these family meetings, if people have different points of view, you want to have the voting, or like, what do people think of this, at the beginning instead of at the end. You know, you would think you'd want to go through a deliberative process,
right,
and then say, okay, well, so should we punish, you know, little Joey here, right? But actually, you want people to say their opinions at the beginning. Otherwise, they wait the entire meeting, and I'm so guilty of this kind of thing, waiting to say what they think, right? So you have to get it out there on the table. And, you know, here's what everybody thinks. And then you figure out, okay, let's move from there. It's like a jury.
By the way,
actually,
we voted my family about whether or not my grandmother should throw the frying pan in my head. And unfortunately, 3-1 voted in favor. So
I don't
have
family meetings. Do you have
family meetings?
I do know that after 9/11, Jim knows the story, my son became obsessed with tall buildings. So we had to spend Friday night and Saturday night up at the top of the Prudential. And then I had to take trips to New York City. So
you went to the Empire State Building.
Six
top
hours
all the time.
At the top of the Empire State Building. Yeah, we were there for I never figured out what that was, but that was how he reacted.
So is that, you know, whenever I hear that there's a formula, we were talking to Michael Norton, who we both love, yesterday, talking about your relationship with money. He's terrific. And, you know, every time we talk to him, I say to myself, and I feel the same way almost every time we talk to you, is this sounds great, but does this go from theory or study to reality? I mean, do people do this? I mean, I understand that their conclusion was those who do, those families which do, are more effective, more resilient, more happy, whatever. What percentage of families actually do this kind of thing? Is it typical, like in my, I know virtually nothing about my grandparents' background. I mean, a couple of them were alive when I was young, a couple of them weren't. Where are the percentages on this? Am I typical or what?
I asked you once where your family came from.
Eastern Europe.
You
I know
told
Eastern
me, Europe. I said, which country? You weren't sure.
Well, I'm not sure. There's a little Russian. There's a little, I don't know.
Here's go ahead. So my family also partially comes from Eastern Europe. And I once asked my grandmother where in Eastern Europe her parents came from or her grandparents or whatever. And she said, no, they're from New York. And I said, like, forever? Yes, they've lived in New York forever. And I said, so are you saying we're Native American? So I don't know. I mean, that's what I can tell you about
that. But what is that? I know this is not in the piece of the New York Times. What is the break? Are a significant number of American families doing this thing where they create and a family narrative, or is this the outlier kind of thing?
I mean, I think that's an outlier, but I think that people are looking for ways to cement their family more closely together. I do think a lot of people have family meetings. However, I think very often those meetings are run exactly the way that corporate board meetings are run. Like, we are one or two people, and we will tell you the way things are going to be. And it turns out that if you run your meeting a little bit more from the bottom up and say, look, you know, kid one and kid two, we're having some problems washing dishes. It looks like nobody's really doing it. We sort of had assignments, but nobody's doing it. What do you think? How do you think that we could get that done? It is amazing. Kids will start saying, okay, well, the problem is that we've had the wrong incentives. If you gave people who did those things this, or if you, you know, I think kids are sort of discounted in the sense that they have a lot of ideas for how the family could function more clearly.
You know what else, too, I think about the family narrative and the family stories that I've just noticed in my own life? When you tell kids, even teenagers who want nothing to do with you, stories about their grandmother interacting with them or what grandpa used to do with them when they were little, or you tell them about, you ask about, they know the story of their birth, because it's about them, too. They're really interested in that. They'll actually be rather riveted when you explain those stories. So I get this completely.
Yeah, Edgar Herwick actually has a segment on our show this Saturday, and he talks to Massachusetts families asking what they do. And there's this guy who runs this fascinating thing called the Family Dinner Project, and he keeps a photo album at the dinner table, because it turns out that people who have family dinners together, we've all heard this research, have better families.
Right.
And the U.S. is pathetic when it comes to family dinners. We're 23rd out of 25 countries in having family dinner together. And here's the worst part about it. Only 17% of the time, when every single person in the family is home, do people eat together.
Really?
I mean, you would think, like, oh, it's because people aren't home together. It's not because people aren't home together. I don't know. We always ate together, I think, when I was a kid.
Me too.
Well, also, but if you eat together, everybody's on their smartphone anyway. Yes. I'm serious. I mean, how many great images are there in movies and television shows of people being together, whether it's couples or families, and when they're physically together, every single person is on their Droid or their iPhone, relating to whomever it is they want, maybe a person across the table, maybe a friend who isn't even there.
Huge mistake.
So
in
what's
any
this, case, guys? What's this? What, go ahead.
Let me just finish my thing. So this guy has a family album next to the table, so that if conversation runs low, they can open a picture and he can say, here's the story of that picture. And it's just kind of fascinating. And the kids love it because they say, oh, really? Uncle so-and-so used to look like that? Why does he look so different? And, you know, and you get talking about
Marjorie's going to go home and start telling stories to her kids, aren't
I know,
you?
I feel like a deadbeat.
I know. Well,
sorry.
There's a deader beat across the table. So you're on tonight. What time is tonight?
Thursday, tonight at 9.
Are you talking about this tonight at 9?
No, we're not.
On Saturday.
Right.
What are you doing tonight? You know?
What's tonight at 9?
I love when this happens. Karen Miller,
Amanda,
listen
what are we
to
doing?
Her. You'll find out tonight. Don't tell her.
Okay.
I don't want you to tell her. Karen Miller, it's been a pleasure. That's the end of today's show. Tomorrow on Open Mic, Emily Rooney has a legendary Emily's List. On our Friday news quiz, the man behind Sky and Telescope magazine, facing off with the founder of the Annals of Improbable Research. That's it for today. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
Thanks so much. We'll see you tomorrow at noon. Bye, everybody.